Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Jim Stein, your host for New Books in Math, a channel of the New Books Network. Our guest today is John Stilwell, author of The Story of Proof. This book could well serve as a history of mathematics, because in developing the evolution of the concept of proof and how it has arisen in the various different mathematical fields, John essentially traces the important milestones in the development of mathematics. John has done an amazing job of collecting and categorizing many of the most important ideas in this area. John, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And a pleasure to have you. John, what motivated you to write this book?
Well, I've been disappointed for some time at sort of the lack of respect for proof in mathematics education. I've been teaching in America, or I was teaching in America for the last 20 years, and typically proof is introduced only at fairly senior levels of undergraduate, as if it was something sophisticated, too sophisticated for beginners. Whereas I think proof runs through all of mathematics. It's the essence of mathematics, really, and there should be some concept of proof from the very beginning.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you. I mean, but one question that would arise is when I took geometry in high school, and I don't want to tell you how many years ago that was, we were first familiarized with the concept of two-column proofs, and somebody told me that they're not doing that in geometry anymore. Is that true?
Well, I don't really know, but as I understand it, a two-column proof is in the left-hand column you make certain statements, and in the right hand column you explain why
or exactly
justifications. So if it simply means justifying claims, that then fair enough. You don't have to lay it out in two columns. You just have to provide justification as you go along, and typically that would be saying by axiom so and so, or because this follows from lines 3 and line 17.
Well, I hope they're doing that in geometry. I mean, I can see discursive proofs. That's what you see in math, you know, in a more standardized math course in at a college or in a journal article.
Yeah. I think it is done in some form, but the very idea of proof is sort of suppressed. You might do proofs, and some people might not do proofs. But the students are not alerted that there is a process called proof, and it has certain characteristics, and it is really itself a part of mathematics.
I certainly agree with you. Before we get into the meat of the book, since you spent so much time studying proof, do you have a favorite proof or a favorite proof technique?
I would say my favorite proof is a proof of the Pythagorean theorem. Probably a very ancient proof. We don't know for sure when it first originated. It's perhaps not as fancy as Euclid's proof and not as strict as Euclid's proof, but it's very convincing. You simply draw a picture. You take your right angle triangle. You take four copies of the triangle and you arrange them in a square. And you will see if you arrange them sort of head to tail that the space in the middle that's left over is simply the square on the hypotenuse. But then you notice you can arrange the four triangles in the same square in a different way. so that the space left over is the sum of the squares on the other two sides. Therefore, sum of the squares on the two sides equals sum on the hypotenuse, QED.
Yeah, I love it. That's one of my favorite proofs, too. You know, the initial proof of a theorem is often quite inelegant and overly lengthy. Certainly a lot of mine were. Why do you think mathematicians spend so much time searching for better ways to prove a theorem once the result is known to be true?
Well, of course, most mathematicians appreciate elegance. And if the proof is ugly for some reason, they would try to find a better one. But there are other reasons. One would be to find a better explanation. The first proof may be so contorted and long that you don't really see the reason why the theorem is true. And there might be a more explanatory proof, such as the proof of the Pythagorean theorem I just mentioned. Another reason and motivation is that you want to find what is the minimum that you really have to assume to prove the theorem. Very often the first proof assumes everything under the sun just because it's convenient, and you would like to trim it down so only the really necessary assumptions are present.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point because, I mean, I know that having done some research mathematics myself, one of the things that I would often do is exactly what you mentioned. I'd look at a theorem and I'd see whether or not I could get by with less or could possibly reach a stronger conclusion from what the author had assumed.
Yes, that's precisely what a lot of people do. Of course, a lot of research mathematicians are in a hurry. And once they've proved the theorem, they want to forget it and go on to something else. But
shiny new toys.
I'm not satisfied with that, and I'm not producing so many theorems that I can afford to rush on to the next one.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned in the preface that logic and computation are important tools for proof, yet logic and computation are less well known than other aspects of mathematics. Why do you think this is the case?
It puzzles me a bit because they were the two things that really interested me as an undergraduate. But then I wasn't at first interested in number theory or algebra or algebraic topology. And a lot of the fashionable areas of mathematics don't pay a lot of attention to logic. So I think it's partly what's fashionable, but it may be the way some mathematicians think. They prefer logic to be sort of unconscious, and they don't want to examine the mechanics of a proof. Whereas I do like to look at the mechanics. I like to see how the pieces fit together, and logic helps you to do that.
I certainly think that's true. You know, you were referring to the Pythagorean theorem earlier, and it has a central place in mathematics. I mean, I think it's the most important theorem in mathematics. I remember reading that Pythagoras, once he had proved it, ordered 100 oxen barbecued, and I don't think there's a single theorem that's been proved that's even worth 60 oxen since then.
I agree.
Yeah. But anyway, do you suppose you could trace a little bit of its history and how established it contributed to the evolution of proof? It must have done so because I think there are like 400 different proofs of it. So people have looked at this in the context of proof as well as in the context of geometry.
Yes, yes, that's true. And not only geometry, because several different civilizations discovered the Pythagorean theorem, even before Pythagoras even. But they saw only certain aspects of it. For instance, the Babylonians seem to have been interested in the number theory aspect. When you have numbers such as 3, 4, and 5, and 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared, this is an interesting relationship between numbers, and you might look for many other triples, Pythagorean triples, as they're called. And the Babylonians were amazingly good at this, and they found examples up in the thousands.
Wow.
So that's one way it can develop and contribute to mathematics. It contributed to number theory by posing a problem, find integer solutions of the equation a squared plus b squared equals c squared. Then, as you said, it contributed a lot to geometry because people wanted to know what is the real reason for the Pythagorean theorem. So they proved it many different ways. And basically it boiled down to the parallel axiom of Euclid. You can't prove it without the parallel axiom, though this might not be obvious in some of the quick
books. It's certainly not obvious to me.
yeah. But if you look carefully at, say, Euclid's proof, Euclid does not introduce the parallel axiom. He sort of avoids it for as long as possible, but he has to bring it in when he's discussing the theory of area of parallelograms, for example, and triangles, which of course require parallels. So Euclid saw that he needed the parallel axiom to prove the Pythagorean theorem. And conversely, if you assume the Pythagorean theorem, you're assuming that squares exist and therefore parallels exist, and the parallel axiom sort of follows. So it's kind of the essence of geometry. In one sense, is the Pythagorean theorem. In another sense, it's the parallel axiom, at least Euclidean geometry. I guess we might talk about non-Euclidean later, but everything begins Euclidean style with parallels and squares and the Pythagorean theorem. Oh, and the third thing that contributed to mathematics was the role of the square root of 2. The Pythagorean theorem tells us that if you've got a square with sides 1 and 1, the hypotenuse is the square root of 2, which it was interesting and shocking to the Pythagoreans because they discovered that root 2 is not a ratio of whole numbers. Until then, they'd thought that everything is whole numbers. So this completely upset their whole theory of everything, as it were. And it was a thorn in the side of Greek mathematics for hundreds of years, which eventually forced them to develop a theory of real numbers in a kind of rudimentary form. And as we know today, there are all sorts of holes in the rational numbers. Root 2 is just one of them. And to fill them in, you've got to create a theory of real numbers. So Pythagorean theorem, in its way, contributed to that development as well.
You know, I've always been impressed by the fact that the Greeks knew that there were five regular polyhedra. I took a course in solid geometry in high school, which was probably the hardest math course I ever took. But I don't think we got to the proof that there were five and only five regular polyhedra. But I think that the proof is included in Euclid's Elements. Is that correct?
It is, and it's really the climax of Euclid's Elements. Everything he's done, or a lot of what he does in that book, leads up to the proof. Now, it's not particularly hard to prove that there are most five, the five that we know of, the tetrahedron cube up to the dodecahedron, icosahedron. But what is hard, surprisingly, is to prove that a dodecahedron actually exists. You can prove that pentagons exist, but how can you be sure when you stick them together in three-dimensional space that they're going to close up and make this nice regular object? It's quite hard to do that, and that's why Euclid took a long time to get there.
You know, this is sort of a sidelight, but I've always been impressed by how incredibly brilliant the Greeks were, considering that they didn't have, you know, pencils and papers to just scratch out ideas when it occurred to them. They didn't have really good, you know, really good writing implements and recording devices, and yet they still got all this incredible mathematics done.
Yeah, I suppose there is that story about Archimedes drawing in the sand. And
yeah.
I suppose that kind of predisposed them to geometry. You could draw triangles and circles and so forth, but you couldn't calculate very well drawing in the sand. There was the abacus at some stage in the history of mathematics, I'm not sure when, which enabled calculation, but the Greeks were not either not doing it or not interested, I would say. So they had this bias towards geometry, and the root 2 business also scared them off number theory. So they managed to do geometry the hard way, as we would see it, but were incredibly good at it.
Yeah, they sure were. You know, calculus is what attracted me to mathematics. Finding the volume of a sphere is a slam dunk using integral calculus, but I've absolutely no idea how the Greeks managed it, and maybe you could give me some insight on this.
Yes, Archimedes is responsible for the theorem, and the way he visualized it was he enclosed the sphere in a cylinder. So the top and bottom of the cylinder touched the sphere at the top and bottom, and the curved side of the cylinder touches the sphere around its equator. And he considered slicing through the sphere, small slices. Now, the way he did this was complicated, and strangely, it involved a bit of physics. He imagined weighing things and balancing things on a lever, and there's a lot of tricky reasoning. Later on, in the 17th century, Cavalieri did a new approach which was similar to Archimedes, but he compared the sphere in the cylinder with a cone in the cylinder, and the volume of the cone was known because basically you could slice it into very small tetrahedra or almost, and this volume is 1/3 base times height. And he was able to compare the inside of the sphere with the outside of the cone and show that they're the same volume. And this is easy, actually. You slice through at the same height, and the slice inside the sphere is the same area as the slice outside the cone. So adding up all the slices, a slightly dodgy procedure, you get equal volumes, and therefore the sphere is 2/3 of the volume of the cylinder, which was Archimedes' way of putting the result.
Well, to me, that's incredible, considering that the idea of slicing occurs naturally when you're using integral calculus. And once you have something like the fundamental theorem of calculus, literally, these are 30-second problems. And there were a couple of moments for me when I thought that mathematics was just so astounding. That was one of them. The other was the fact that when I found out that sine x was x minus x cubed over 3 factorial plus x to the 5th over 5 factorial. And we might get to that later, because that's absolutely my favorite theorem in mathematics.
I admire that one too.
Yeah, Taylor was absolutely brilliant.
Archimedes, without a means of calculation, could do things that we now do by calculus. It was amazing.
Yeah, that's why I say these guys were just unbelievably brilliant. Because I've heard some mathematicians beside yourself talk about the way that the Greeks approached some of these more complicated problems, and they all realize that these are intellectual tour de forces, which the discovery of calculus is an intellectual tour de force, but the use of calculus is not.
It's the theoretical part that's amazing. Once you've got the theory, then you can see it applies to physical objects.
Okay, let's look at some different branches of mathematics, because that's, in a sense, that's how you've organized your book. So Kronecker said that the integers were the result of God, all else was the result of man. But you mentioned the proof of the square root of 2 being irrational. We've been doing a lot of work with those non-integer results, and the rationals, the transcendentals, etc. And maybe you'd like to talk a little, because you started talking about this earlier when we developed the real numbers, so maybe you'd like to talk a little about that.
Yes, that's bringing us up to the 19th century, and Kronecker was a 19th century mathematician, very interested in numbers. But even he was forced to use transcendental numbers in some of his work, even though he's sometimes quoted as saying he didn't believe in them. He did use them, and his way around that was to consider not only natural numbers, but infinite processes on the natural numbers, like the infinite series of sine that you just mentioned. You can make rational numbers, and you can start adding them. And if you add more and more, the sum may approach something interesting. And we now know that you can get all real numbers in this way. Dedekind had it very different way of approaching that, and that was to consider infinite sets of rational numbers, imagining root 2, for instance, as a separation of the rational numbers into those that are less than root 2 and those that are greater than root 2. Now, you can describe all real numbers in this way by the way they separate the rational numbers into two parts. Kronecker didn't like this because this involves infinite sets, which he was leery of. But Dedekind was perfectly happy to use infinite sets of real, or rather rational numbers. And this idea caught on in the 19th century, and it began to be believed that everything could be arithmetized in the sense that it was either reducible to natural numbers or infinite sets of natural numbers. So they took a Greek idea and pushed it a little further, because the Greeks didn't like to accept infinite sets as completed wholes, and Dedekind and others were willing to do this, and in that way they pushed the theory of real numbers into reality. It was something approachable only vaguely before then, but if you accept infinite sets, it's a concrete, actual thing.
Yeah, I remember there was a lot of difficulty in accepting the works of Cantor on infinite, you know, on infinite sets. And I remember that I had originally thought that Cantor was this individual who was essentially vilified by the German mathematical establishment. But I've later found out that that wasn't necessarily true. What happened was they held him in a lot of respect for the work that he did in other areas. But when he started messing around with infinities, they got very upset about it. Maybe that was the holdover from Kronecker.
Yes. I think Kronecker was hostile to Cantor, but Dedekind was not. Dedekind was quite friendly, and he corresponded a lot with Cantor. And Cantor's essentially great contribution was to discover that infinite sets are of more than one kind. We know that the natural numbers are infinite and form an infinite set. They go 1, 2, 3, and they never end. And it was thought perhaps for a while that all infinite sets could be viewed in this way as going first member, second member, third member, but never ending. But Cantor showed that the real numbers are not like this. You cannot begin to enumerate the real numbers and say first real number, second real number, third real number, and exhaust them all by imagining continuing that process. It just cannot be done. So it was impossible to think of the real numbers as a process, a step-by-step process that could be approached. And this was shocking to people like Kronecker. Not shocking to Dedekind, but it certainly disturbed a lot of mathematicians in the 19th century.
Yeah, I think that this particular proof technique, the diagonal proof, is worth mentioning, because it just permeates so many different areas of mathematics. I mean, I look at Cantor as one of, you know, Cantor hit for the cycle. He had objects named after him, he had theorems named after him, and he had a proof technique named after him. And there are very few mathematicians who have something like that on their resume.
Yes, the diagonal argument, I think, is one of the great ideas of mathematics. And it's quite a simple idea, really, hard to describe on the radio.
Yeah, you need to see a proof in order to appreciate it.
You need to see the real numbers written out and the diagonal drawn and so forth. But essentially what it says is that if you've got a list of real numbers, first real number, second real number, third real number, you can make a number that's not on the list. And you can make it in a very constructive way. And because of this, the same technique applies to other situations. For instance, if you had a list of computable functions, you can make a function which is not computable, or you can define one at any rate. This was an idea that was taken up by Turing, for instance. And if you try to analyze what goes wrong, why can't you compute this non-computable function, you realize that it's because there are unsolvable problems about computing machines or algorithms. And this leads to unsolvable problems in throughout mathematics. It leads to incompleteness, the impossibility of proving everything. So all of these results are descendants of Cantor's diagonal argument.
Yeah, you know, when you're talking about problems that could not be solved, one of the great results in the development of algebra, and indeed in the development of mathematics, was Galois' proof of the insolvability of the general quintic. This problem has a long and fascinating history and an amazing culmination, and maybe you could tell us a little about it.
Yes, the history is fascinating. It's dramatic. It goes through the solution of quadratic equations and cubic equations, and there was a lot of fights about that in fourth degree equations, but nobody could solve the fifth degree equation. And this was baffling because it seemed that you just had to be a little more clever, because solving cubic was a lot harder than solving quadratic. So solving fourth degree was a bit harder than solving cubic. So it held mathematics up for a couple of centuries before Galois was able to show that you've got to think on a different level. You've got to think about the nature of equations, the nature of the roots of equations, and particularly the symmetry of the roots. A quintic equation has five different roots, and Galois imagined what happens when you interchange, write the roots in a different order, what happens? And he realized that there is a whole theory of symmetry, and by studying this, which we now call group theory, you can come up with some concepts which explain what is happening when you solve the quadratic, cubic, fourth degree equations, and why you cannot solve the quintic. So he not only proved that it was unsolvable, but he came up with a comprehensive theory which settles all kinds of questions, not only to do with equations, but with geometry and physics or many other things now involve group theory, the theory of symmetry.
Yeah, you know, one of absolutely the most, the most fascinating anecdotes in mathematics is the idea that Galois presumably was having an affair with the wife of a nobleman, and the nobleman challenged him to a duel, and Galois basically knew that he wasn't going to survive the duel. He was like 21 years old. And so on the night before the duel, he spent his last hours on Earth writing down the proof of this amazing result. To me, that's just one of the great anecdotes in mathematics.
Yeah, yes, one of the great tragedies, really. But luckily, he wrote enough that it was eventually understood. But at the time, I think he sent it to Cauchy, understand it, and didn't think it was worth pursuing. And it was 10, 15 years, I think, before Liouville took the time to read the mathematics of Galois carefully and figure out what was going on and finally convince people that Galois had really proved this result.
I mean, I hate to say it, but if it had been me, I would have been on the first train out of France, even though they didn't have. And so I could do some more math. Good grief.
Yeah. Galois was a kind of angry young man, I think, and he didn't consider his future as much as he should have.
You know, it's sort of like my wife. My wife seems to think that I'm not as practically oriented as I could be, and I spend too much time thinking about mathematics. And I guess that's what mathematicians do. We spend a lot of time thinking about mathematics, and we tend to neglect other things that are more important. But I know I remember to keep my doctor's appointments, and if anybody ever challenges me to a duel, I'm moving to another country.
Yeah, good idea. I would agree with you.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the 18th century, which was when Galois was around, some really important mathematics and proof techniques have arisen from what we now think of as recreational mathematics. And the Königsberg bridge problem, which marks a milestone in the development of combinatorics, is one of these. And it has a fascinating theory, some fascinating people in it, and a fascinating resolution. Hopefully you'll tell us about it.
Yes, yes. This was one of Euler's discoveries, at which he seemed to toss off every day. But the Königsberg bridges is a very lasting contribution, because everybody can understand the problem. You have a city with a river and two islands and a few bridges, and people like to take walks along the bridges, and they wonder whether there's a walk which will use each bridge exactly once, and they can't ever find one, but they don't know why not. And they put the problem to Euler, and he solves it very quickly by what we now know as graph theory. He reduces it to a problem about dots, which are the land masses, and lines, which are the bridges, and imagines tracing a path through these lines, and notices that each time you pass through a dot, you would use up two of the edges. And therefore, unless you have all even numbers of edges at each dot, you're never going to be able to use them up with a walk that uses each bridge exactly once. Simple idea, but it led to a big field of graph theory and later to topology as well. Topology sort of generalizes from these one-dimensional objects called lines to two and three and four-dimensional objects and makes things by sticking them together. And there are all kinds of problems, all kinds of methods. Topology has been one of the most fruitful branches of mathematics in leading to new methods of proof and also new ideas in geometry.
You know, one of the things that sort of interests me about proof is that there are some really simple proof techniques that occur in a lot of different areas and are so obvious. And one, as you were talking about Euler counting things associated with the various dots and lines connecting them, it occurred to me that one of the classic proof techniques, which we haven't really talked about yet, is the pigeonhole principle. I always thought that was about the easiest proof technique to understand. And maybe you could shed some insight on when you first saw the proof technique of the pigeonhole principle used in a proof.
Now, that's a good question. And as I recall, this technique is due to Dirichlet. And he used it to prove a theorem about approximating irrational numbers by rationals. And he went on to use it to prove that there's a solution of the Pell equation, which is the equation x squared minus ny squared equals 1, where n is a whole number that's not a square. For instance, x squared minus 2y squared equals 1 is a simple Pell equation. And it's not at all obvious that there's always a solution of those equations. For instance, if you take x squared minus 61y squared equals 1, the smallest solution has about 10 or 12 digits for each of x and y. And yet, Dirichlet was able to prove its existence by this simple pigeonhole principle, which says if you've got n pigeonholes and more than n pigeons, there's going to be at least two pigeons in one pigeonhole.
Yeah, it's just it's so completely obvious, and yet nonetheless, because I used it a few times, and I worked in some areas in combinatorics later in my career, and I was amazed at how useful this particular technique is. And I thought it, one of the reasons that I asked you about this was because I thought it was such an obvious thing. It might have been traced back to the Greeks, but the Greeks were investigating geometry, and this type of proof doesn't really show up in geometry.
No, it doesn't. And as far as I know, it doesn't show up till fairly late in the piece. This Dirichlet proof is probably 1830s. There may be examples before then, but it got its name, the pigeonhole principle, I think, from Dirichlet. So maybe it wasn't used before him.
Well, another proof principle that I always liked because of the name of it was the Chinese restaurant principle. in counting the number of ways that you can do several different things. Because I used to go to these Chinese restaurants when I was a kid, and I remember they had a menu in which said, you know, the dinner, you could choose one from column, you could choose an appetizer from column A, a main course from column B. And this was the first math question that really sort of interested me, because I asked my father how many, my father would always order different meals, whereas I always had the same thing. And I asked my father how many different types of meals you could have. And he said, well, you know, there are 8 appetizers and there are 12 main courses. So you could have 8 times 12, 96 different meals. And it really wasn't until I learned this in a Chinese restaurant. And it amazed me later on to discover that, yes, it had the name, the Chinese restaurant principle.
So this is also the kind of argument that you use to prove that there are n factorial ways of ordering n objects, and n choose k ways of choosing k things from n. You figure out how many ways to choose the first thing, how many ways to choose the second, multiply those together, how many ways to choose the third, multiply again, and so on and so on. As far as I know, this goes back to medieval times. There was a mathematician in what is now Spain, Levi Ben Gershon, who worked out the number of permutations and combinations of n things, or n choosing k things from n. I think he was the first, and that's probably the first instance of this multiplying principle of that you would use in the Chinese restaurant.
You know, that's one of the things that I really enjoyed about reading your book, because it is sort of a history of mathematics. And you come across people like, until, you know, I had never heard of Levi Ben Gershon. And there are a lot of interesting people in mathematics because mathematics has been going on for thousands of years, that there are going to be a lot of interesting people that you've never heard of. And you come across some of them and some of the anecdotes in your book, which is another reason that I enjoyed reading it.
Yes, I think it is entertaining and interesting that sometimes important contributions were made by obscure people. Of course, it's mostly the Newtons and the Eulers and the Archimedes who come up with the big discoveries. But once in a while, something comes from nowhere. In a way, Galois was like that.
You know, we talked earlier, we very, very briefly touched on Alan Turing, but I'd like to talk a little more about him in a different context. One of the first major problems in the theory of computers was the halting problem. Two different approaches were taken to solving this problem, but certainly the one adopted by Alan Turing involved a distinctly different type of proof, and perhaps you could talk a little about this.
Yes, I could. Turing used the diagonal argument, and he considered computers which had writing, a strip of paper to write things on. So you could write, for instance, the decimal expansion of root 2. You could write a 1 and then a dot and then a 1, 4, 1, 4, and so on. And he asked the question, what are the computable numbers? They will include all the rational numbers. They'll include a lot of irrational numbers like root 2 and pi, because we know ways of computing them. But he also asked, if you're given a machine, which is like being given a computer program in today's language, can you tell whether this program will compute a real number? Because you can set it running and you can watch what it does, and it might write a 1 and a dot and a 1, 4, 1, 4. But if you wait long enough, it might go back and erase all it's done. You don't know. No matter how long you look at the machine, you don't know whether it's going to compute a real number or not. And this can be formalized by the diagonal argument. You can indeed show there is no algorithm or machine that will recognize the machines that print real numbers. And why not? Well, it turns out that the problem is knowing whether the machine is going to halt or not. If you could settle that question, you'll be able to settle the question about real numbers. So Turing realized this means that the halting problem is not solvable. And many other unsolvable problems follow from this. Problems in logic and group theory and topology, number theory, all sorts of unsolvable problems have since been found as descendants of this unsolvable halting problem.
You know, one of the truly counterintuitive results in mathematics is the Banach-Tarski theorem, which relies heavily on the axiom of choice. Could you talk a little about the Banach-Tarski theorem and what is the axiom of choice and how does it make an appearance in proofs?
The Banach-Tarski theorem is indeed a very paradoxical sounding theorem. It says that if you take a solid ball, a meter in diameter, you can decompose that into a finite number of parts, I believe five is possible, and put those parts together without stretching or bending them in any way, just moving them in rigidly in space. You can put them together to form two balls the same size as the original. So in theory, you could take a ball the size of a pea, say, and make two peas and three peas and a million peas and a billion peas. You could eventually make a volume the size of the sun simply by decomposing and rearranging the pieces. Now, this sounds absurd, I know. And it's not the kind of decomposition you could make by cutting with a knife. But nevertheless, there is some decomposition of the ball into clouds of points. You think maybe red points and blue points and green points and so forth. Very cloudy looking sets. These sets exist according to the axiom of choice. Now, what does the axiom of choice say? Well, to give a simple example, everybody, and to take the sort of opposite end of an axiom of choice theorem, everybody will agree that if you've got an infinite set, you can choose an element from it and then choose an element from what's left and choose an element from what's left of that and so on. And you can keep on going forever if this is an infinite set. So this tells you that every infinite set contains a countable subset, a set that has a first member, second member, third member, and so on. That sounds completely plausible. Nevertheless, we had to make infinitely many choices to prove that theorem. And it really is an instance of the axiom of choice. You cannot prove that theorem without some kind of choice principle. There is no way to define this countable subset. Now, the axiom of choice is somewhat of a generalization of that idea, but not a big generalization. It's about choosing from infinitely many sets. And it just says you can. But surprisingly, it has these paradoxical and some might say unacceptable consequences about one ball being equal to two balls and that sort of thing. As a result, some mathematicians dispute the axiom of choice, say we shouldn't use this axiom. And others say, okay, we admit you have to use it because it does simplify mathematics a lot. A lot of the things that we want to be true in mathematics, like every vector space has a basis, every ring has a maximal ideas, things that algebraists constantly appeal to, actually depend on the axiom of choice. So on the one hand, it's very convenient, even necessary for the mathematics that some people do. On the other hand, it has unpleasant consequences from the point of view of many mathematicians. So as long as you say this is an axiom, certain things follow from it, certain things don't follow unless you accept the axiom of choice, that's about where it stands at the moment. We do know that it's not possible. It's somewhat like the parallel axiom in geometry. It's not possible to prove it from more elementary axioms.
Perhaps you'd care to comment on what I heard. I can't remember who did this, but it was a British mathematician, I think, in the early 20th century. Maybe it was Bertrand Russell. Described the problem with the axiom of choice as saying, if I give you a pair of shoes, you can give me a rule on choosing one of the shoes. Say, take the left shoe. But if I give you a pair of socks, you can't give me a rule that will tell me how to choose a sock.
That's precisely it. Yes, if you have infinitely many pairs of socks, the axiom of choice says there's a set that contains one member of each pair. But there, as you say, there is no rule for describing this set. And that's what many people object to in the axiom of choice. They like things to be describable by some definition or rule.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. You know, another thing about your book that it's a theme that goes continually through the book is that you often see theorems that you think are in a specific area of mathematics that are proved using quite different tools from a different area of mathematics. The first proof I saw of the fundamental theorem of algebra required complex variables. Is there a strictly algebraic proof of the fundamental theorem of algebra?
I don't believe there is. I'm not sure whether this apparent fact is provable in some sense, but in a sense, yeah, it has to involve some concepts from analysis, because the very concept of complex number, like the concept of real number, involves infinity in a big way. So if you want your fundamental theorem of algebra to say every polynomial has a root in the complex numbers, then it's not so surprising that analysis would come into it. It is somewhat surprising, but you sort of underestimate the complexity of the concept of complex numbers. Now, there is an alternative, which is due to Kronecker, because Kronecker, as I've mentioned, didn't like big infinities, and he didn't like proofs that didn't construct the object that's claimed to exist. He had a different proof, which says that every polynomial has a root in a certain field, not necessarily the complex numbers, but a field which he is easily able to define. And the definition is, I describe it in the book, but it has to do with equivalence classes of polynomials. You start with your original polynomial whose root you're seeking, and you consider all other polynomials modulo that polynomial. And this gives congruence classes, and these form a field, as you're able to show. And this is the field that Kronecker thinks you should be looking in to find the root of the polynomial. He called this the fundamental theorem of general arithmetic, and it was his opponent to the fundamental theorem of algebra.
Okay, that's sort of interesting, because you can sort of see that what people are talking about is that when we have our limited view of algebra, you know, the type of view of algebra that you get when you go into high school and they talk about polynomials, that there's obviously larger, these structures are in some way incomplete, using the word incomplete vaguely, and that you need larger structures in order to sense the full completeness of the things that you're talking about.
Yes, and that was one of Kronecker's contributions. He found structures that do complete the theory of polynomials, but they complete it in a constructive sort of way. You can describe, they're not uncountable, for instance, they're countable, and you can describe their members in a fairly concrete and explicit way.
Another great theorem is the prime number theorem, and it's a statement about how the primes are distributed among the integers. And as we know, mathematicians are fascinated by primes. Why is the prime number theorem important, and why do we care how the primes are distributed? And were there any interesting proofs encountered along the way to proving this result?
Yes, I suppose this is a matter of curiosity, but also the fact that famous mathematicians such as Gauss thought about it and conjectured about it, but were not able to prove it. And there's the general mysteriousness of primes. We know there are infinitely many of them, but they form such an irregular sequence that it is difficult to visualize, and the density of the sequence is difficult to estimate. And so the prime number theorem was a great triumph in describing in an asymptotic way how many primes are among the first n numbers. And it was a hard theorem to prove. It used complex analysis, as you mentioned before. The fundamental theorem of algebra also uses. And for a long time, it was thought the complex analysis was necessary. G.H. Hardy, the English mathematician from the early 20th century, conjectured that it was not possible to prove the prime number theorem without using complex analysis. This was later found out to be false. And in the 1940s, Selberg and Erdős both produced so-called elementary proofs of the prime number theorem, proofs that in principle use just natural numbers, but they use them in a way that's kind of guided by analysis. And their proof is not any easier. If anything, it's harder than the ones using complex analysis. So it's still a somewhat mysterious theorem. And one recent tidbit about the prime number theorem that I know, a colleague of mine spent a whole summer rewriting the proof of the prime number theorem so that it could be checked by computer. This has become a thing recently with big and complex proofs. Mathematicians have become uncertain about their correctness unless they're checked by a computer. And just writing the proof of the prime number theorem so that it can be checked by a computer is a whole summer's worth of work.
Well, you know, we're coming to the end of the interview, and what you just said leads into one of the most interesting results in mathematics in the 20th century, the bombshell result that no one expected, Gödel's result that there exist undecidable propositions. And the proof has an interesting history involving the mechanization of the possibility of proving things. And so what is an undecidable proposition, and how did Gödel go about proving this result?
First, I should say that an undecidable proposition is undecidable in a relative sense. You can say something is undecidable relative to, say, Euclidean geometry or Euclid's axiom or to Peano's axioms for number theory. Because if that means that this proposition, let's call it P, cannot be proved or disproved in the given axiom system, let's call the axiom system S. But of course, if so, it would be, S would remain consistent if you added this P to it as a new axiom. So this means P is decidable relative to itself. If you take it as an axiom, which you're free to do since it can't be disproved, then it is provable. So undecidability is a relative concept. It just says given a certain axiom system S, there may be propositions not provable or disprovable by S. But the interesting thing is, as you say, Gödel showed that this is true of number theory. If you take, say, the Peano axioms for number theory, there are certain statements P of number theory such that neither P nor its negation is provable in the Peano axioms. And this was a big surprise because I mentioned Euclid's axioms before. I think it's true that every statement you can make in the language of geometry is either provable or disprovable in Euclid's axioms. There's no incompleteness there. Number theory, despite being a seemingly very elementary part of mathematics, is incomplete. The known undecidable statements, unfortunately, are none of the ones that mathematicians have struggled with. They were invented by logicians, and mathematicians as a whole have not been terribly fascinated by them. Nevertheless, it is true that not everything can be proved in number theory. No matter what system you take, as long as it's consistent, there will be some things that it fails to prove. And this was Gödel's big result, and he proved it, as you mentioned, by establishing a kind of parallel between logic and computation. He showed that logic could be arithmetized. Anything you did with logic, mathematical reasoning, could be simulated by a computation with numbers. And because of this, he was able to prove the incompleteness of number theory.
You know, John, I strongly recommend to any listener who's really interested in an in-depth history of mathematics, it's sort of a lot more fun reading the story of proof than, say, going through the four-volume World of Mathematics that I went through when I was younger. So it's a valuable addition to that field. John, if someone wants to get, if a listener would like to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
They could email me. My email is stillwell@usfca.edu. That's probably the best way.
Okay. And also, do you have any other projects on the horizon that you might come back and talk to us about?
I'm thinking about writing a kind of parallel book on the concepts of mathematics rather than the methods of proof. I touch on various concepts in the story of proof, but not in a systematic way. And eventually I'd like to write a book that's more systematic in describing the evolution of mathematical concepts.
An interesting idea, which I think will take you quite some time to do it.
I'm sure.
John, it's been a pleasure, and thanks for coming on the show. Take care.
Thanks for having me, Jim.